Previously on Beta.
Charlie and I forgot to put cheese between us, and before I knew it, there was Kirsten.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves, back with more of the best of Europe. Thanks, nobody's getting me on the face at all. These guys are losers.
And what are we going to do?
Get that done.
Yeah, we're going to get a nice little sweep, take the brooms out.
All right. Woo-woo. Have a great day.
Woo-woo.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Radiolab's Latif Nasser gives us the lowdown on his new Netflix docuseries, Connected, The Hidden Science of Everything.
I have a kind of obsessive personality. I get excited about a lot of things, and then I get excited hard. And that basically is my only professional superpower, I think. Enthusiasm, you know?
Also, writer Melissa Falavino on her debut essay collection, Tomboyland.
And it wasn't until much later in life when I started to inhabit my body in the way that I inhabit it now, which is like much less feminine, much more androgynously, and understanding that that was actually where I felt most powerful and where I felt most at home in my body.
But first.
And I'm a first generation American, you know, like it's hard to be first generation because you have to learn how to be American and teach your parents how to be American too, you know? You guys, my mom had never seen Girl Scouts before in her life. Never. First time she saw Girl Scouts, she thought they were Border Patrol agents. In training.
That's comedian and actress Cristela Alonso from her Netflix special, Lower Classy. Cristela is also a trailblazer. She became the first Latina woman to create, produce, write, and star in her own American primetime sitcom, Cristela, which aired on ABC from 2014 to 2015. Since then, she also became the first Latina lead in a Pixar animated film when she lent her voice to Cruz Ramirez in the film Cars 3. Cristela soundtracks her own incredible life and career in her book, Music to My Years, a mixtape memoir of growing up and standing up. Cristela joined us from her home in LA, where she also hosts the podcast, To Be Continued. She says that music has always played a vital role in her life.
It's always been this extra character, this family member that I think actually helps the conversation move, if that makes sense. So it's this weird thing where my mom grew up in a very kind of like a submissive kind of like family where, you know, women were always seen submissive to men. And I always found it interesting that with her, sometimes she couldn't vocalize what she wanted to say, but then she'd play a song and you kind of knew what she was trying to express at that moment. And I noticed it from I noticed that from just being a little kid, like I knew that. And I used that as an example for the rest of my life. And I noticed that even though we grew up way below poverty, we were always so happy. Some of the best moments we had were with music. We could just, it always just seemed like it, a song could fill in details that we couldn't encapsulate in words.
Very well said. Yeah. As you mentioned, you grew up very poor. So poor, in fact, that you and your family actually squatted in an abandoned diner for the first 7 years of your life. What was that like?
You know, I loved my time there, and obviously I knew nothing to compare it to. So it really wasn't till I was in my 20s, like I wrote in my book, that I realized that we were squatters. It's that thing where, you know, again, as a child, you're taught everything and you kind of feel that that's just the way it is. It's kind of hard to miss something that you don't know exists.
Yeah. When you were only 8 years old, you had to translate English TV shows into Spanish for your mother, even the nightly news. How did you manage to translate the nightly news for your mother?
You know, you do the best you can. It's really, I mean, it really is. That, I think, is some, that's a skill that a lot of, you know, kids of immigrants have that I think, I always say, a lot of us tend to take it for granted because it's just how we lived. And it's just our experience, but it was hard, you know, because at that point I had to get on a different grade level than everybody I was going to school with. I had to learn about politics and, you know, world events as they were happening trying to explain them as I was learning the words. So it was really hard. The good thing, though, is that during the news back then, you could actually follow a news story every day. So every time they had new information, you could build on it. So I started making sense of it. And sometimes I think it would make sense to her and sometimes it wouldn't. And I think she kind of just appreciated the effort, you know, but now, I mean, it's a skill that I, you know, it's a skill I still have. I can, you know, I watch anything. I can translate it for anybody in Spanish while I'm watching it. You know, it's a skill that never goes away.
Yeah. Growing up, you were a big fan of the sitcom The Golden Girls. What was it about that show that resonated with you?
I'm a big fan of sitcoms, classic TV. But there was something about The Golden Girls that I loved in that they seemed to have a natural energy, chemistry, where the characters were written in a way where they would insult each other and laugh at each other. There was something about that that I loved because it was real life.
We're a family here. Well, not the conventional one, but we love each other. And
excuse me, Snoop?
Liar.
Rhino?
Lizard. It's real love, Mr. Benson.
And also with the Golden Girls, I mean, you have an immigrant mother and her, like, first-generation daughter. It's Sophia and Dorothy. And it always bothers me that people don't talk about that angle enough. You know, it's like, it's the same situation I had with my mother, but because Sophia's white and she's from Italy, we just tend to not even think about the fact that she's an immigrant. You know, so it's interesting because to me, that relationship really reminded me of my mom and I. My mom was a short little woman that looked just like Sophia, you know, and, you know, for me, I was kind of like Dorothy, where I was really into school and I was, you know, so for me, it just seemed familiar. And even now, I just don't understand why we never dive into that narrative about, like, immigration, even though, because right now immigration is just a hot topic for so many. Why not use that and see how we treat it and saw those characters depicted in that manner?
That's a very good point. Very good idea, too. In your book, you write about a song by Selena called Dreaming of You. Can you tell me a bit about this song and what it means to you?
You know, Selena is such an icon to so many people in the Latino community, especially Latinas. I grew up in Texas, 2 hours away from where she lived. And it's this thing where when a lot of times when we talk about Selena, we'll always mention her hits in Spanish. And for me, Dreaming of You, that was going to be one of her first hits in, like, one of her first songs in English, you know, crossing over to, like, the quote unquote American market. And to me, that was such a big deal.
Late at night when all the world is sleeping, I stay up and think of you.
We were finally going to show people the specialness of this icon that we all loved. So that song represented so much to me because it almost felt like hope. There's this thing that I feel constantly when I think about, like, my community, and it's hope that people will see that we're just like everyone else. And that song, for some reason, that song sung by Selena, to me was just, it was hope that, it was a light that just flickered and went away way too soon, and it just gave us a hope of what could happen. And it's, again, that's why I wrote the book about songs. There's some songs that it doesn't matter how you feel when you listen to those songs, they dominate whatever current feeling you have, and they send you back to that moment when you first listened to that song and realized that it was going to be an important song in your life.
I'll be dreaming of you tonight till tomorrow. I'll be holding your tight, and there's nowhere in the world I'd rather be than here in my room dreaming about you.
You really embraced doing theater in your youth, so how did you end up making the transition from theater to stand-up?
Oh, that's a great question. So my goal in life was to always be on Broadway. I loved Broadway. My entire childhood was devoted to getting on Broadway. You know, I never played outside. I never did anything. Summer vacation, I'd go to the library to read scripts and everything. Like, just enthralled in it. And I was the drama geek in high school. You know, I was president of the drama club. I won all these trophies and everything. Then my freshman year in college, I had a teacher tell me that as a Latina, I could do West Side Story and Chorus Line. And that was it. And it was this thing where the idea was so rare to me because my high school, we were about 99% Latino. And we were doing shows. I mean, we were doing any show we wanted to. My freshman year, we did The Diary of Anne Frank. You know what I mean? Like, you know, so it's like theater was theater. I didn't know that outside of high school, I was going to be limited by other people. So I did West Side Story and I did Chorus Line. And then I figured, well, what do I do now? You know, so it didn't matter if I was talented or good enough. I didn't look the part. So, you know, when Hamilton came out and the Schuyler sisters were different and everybody embraced it, I realized people can suspend disbelief and buy into the story if it's told well. But back then, I realized that I loved performing so much that the only way that I would ever get a chance was to write my own stuff. And that's how it switched into stand-up. And at that time, I had taken care of my mom, who had passed away. I was so depressed. I couldn't afford therapy. And I started writing about my mom and taking it on stage.
My mom, like, not kidding, she would buy photo frames, picture frames, and she would keep the pictures that came with the frames. And she would hang them up on the wall. And she would call them her white family. And every time we would get in trouble, she would use them as an example. Cristela, you're flunking math. Why can't you be like your cousin Peggy? You know?
And people responded to it. And in a way, I think that's why my stand-up always kind of seems to have this flow where it's about my life. It's about commentary. It's about social commentary because, you know, I grew up thinking that's what artists do, right? You hold a mirror up to society and show them their faults, you know, and we think. So for me, stand-up was an evolution of how I was able to do my, like, one-woman show on Broadway.
Fast forward a decade from when you were doing stand-up and started it, and then you become the first Latina to star, write, and produce your own network TV show, the ABC sitcom Cristela. The show was based on the time in your life when you had to move in with your sister to help take care of her kids and your mother. Why did you want your sitcom to focus on this particular time in your life?
You know, for me, I actually wanted to show people again. I think that when you tell a story, people will always have an idea. They'll imagine it the way they want to, you know? So when I was pitching the show, I was pitching a show about my life at that point where we were all so crowded in a house trying to make it, trying to, you know, kind of survive in a way. And those times, though, they were some of my best memories, you know, seeing my mother with, like, her grandkids and just, you know, just kind of having this thing where I wanted to show that. And I wanted to show how you could be happy with not having this, like, wealthy family on TV. And also, I wanted to lead up to my mother's death because I actually thought it was important to show that these memories we were making were actually leading up to this moment that, you know, we would cherish our entire lives.
You don't show someone you love them by giving them movies and raw fish. No, you show people that you love them by yelling at them and pointing out their every flaw. Yes, so that they can correct them and become better people. Fine, you're a stubborn old woman who's too afraid to go to the doctor. Why are you yelling? You weren't even worried. Yes, I was. I was hiding it. No one worries more about a mom than I do. Oh, so now it's a contest. You make tea, I quit school, I win.
22 episodes of Christella aired during the 2014-15 TV season, but then it was canceled. What happened?
I never got a real bona fide reason for it. I will tell you that at that point, I was guest hosting on The View once 1 week a month during my hiatus weeks. And after my show was canceled, they literally called me and offered me The View, you know, 10 minutes later. So it was really back to back. It was just kind of, it almost seemed so obvious that it was kind of like, you really don't think that I can put these pieces together. Like you think that jigsaw puzzles are way beyond my intellect, you know, like it was right there, really obvious. So it was this thing. They offered me another show. They're like, just come and pitch another show. Then we'll get it on the air. And I remember telling them, but you had the show I wanted to do. Like, that was my show. I'm not here to make money. I'm not here to just come up with stories so that I can get back on TV. Like, that was my baby. And I loved it. And I just, that's not who I am. Other people can do that, and that's fantastic for them. But I know who I am, and I know what I do. I know what I believe. And I can't do anything unless I really believe in it.
Very well said. To many people who are hearing this, especially our producer Adam's kids, you are not Christella Alonso, but Cruz Ramirez from Pixar's animated blockbuster Cars 3. Tell us how that experience happened and what it means for you, what it meant for you to be the first Mexican-American woman to lead a Disney Pixar film.
You know, it's really funny because when I got the audition, I didn't know I was auditioning. My agents just told me that Pixar wanted me to fly up there to get a tour of Pixar. And I thought, well, that sounds kind of cool. And, you know, I went up there. They showed me the storyboards for Cars 3. And after the meeting, I was like, well, I wish you luck on that. You know, and they're like, no, we want you to audition. I went into the booth and it started out as a small part. But then they would fly me up to Pixar to do these voiceover sessions on, you know, at the studio. And between breaks and lunch, I would tell them stories about how I grew up. And they loved so many of those stories that they made it into Cruz's stories. So the character Cruz is actually inspired by a lot of my childhood and a lot of my issues, which is so weird to see me so represented. Like, that character is me.
Dream small, Cruz. That's what my family used to say. Dream small or not at all. They were just trying to protect me. But I was the fastest kid in town, and I was gonna prove them wrong.
What happened?
When I got to my first race, I figured it out.
What?
That I didn't belong.
You have a beautiful story about your mother in your Netflix special. You talk about her in your book, and you, of course, famously had her as a character on your ABC sitcom, Christella, as we were just talking about. How has your mother inspired you?
She was a woman that came here from a different country with a second grade education, not knowing the language, and she came here because she wanted her kids to have a chance that she didn't. And by that I mean, you know, she and her husband, my dad, they married because he kidnapped her. And that's what they did culturally in the village that she grew up. She didn't want that for her kids. She wanted the kids to have a chance. So she came here. And, you know, when I was younger, when I graduated high school and told her I wanted to perform, she thought I was crazy. You know, she thought I was crazy for having this, like, crazy dream that she couldn't understand. And I always told her, it's funny to me that you don't see how big your dream was. And even though we're poor in this country, we're so full of joy and happiness and have everything we have because of you. Like, don't minimize what you've done.
And it was sad. But at the same time, I thought, how great is it that I got the chance to say that? How great is it that I had that last moment, that I got to tell her how I felt, how much I loved her, right before she died? And then she didn't die.
And sometimes I think about it, I'm like, everything that I've been able to do in my life, everything has been because of her choice. And, you know, she never thought she was special. And for me, I want everybody to know that she was so special because I wouldn't be here without her.
Cristello Alonso, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Cristello Alonso is a comedian and the author of Music to My Years, a mixtape memoir of growing up and standing up. Find out more about Cristello at wpr.org/beta.
I happen to be a very vocal interviewer, so I'll be like, wow, oh man, oh amazing. Like, and I just do that naturally, and then I like cut it all out because I'm like embarrassed of my zealousness.
Radiolab's very vocal and very zealous Latif Nasser joins us to talk about his Netflix series, Connected. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you listen to Radiolab, you're probably familiar with Latif Nasser's work. He's the show's director of research, and he's produced stories on a wide range of subjects, including medieval robots and a polar bear who liked to have sex with grizzly bears. Latif also hosted the 6-episode podcast series called The Other Latif. It's about a guy with the same name as Latif, who is a detainee at Guantanamo Bay. Now Latif, the Radiolab one, is the host of a Netflix docuseries called Connected.
It's a science series about the ways, all the various ways, we are connected to one another and to our world. And I basically go around the world and sniff out these sort of stories of subtle, surprising science that, that hopefully will make viewers see the world in a whole new way.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. It seems pretty involved. Each episode has a theme like surveillance or poop, and you tell several mini stories in each episode, and you travel, as you mentioned, to practically every corner of the planet to do it. What are the biggest challenges you face in creating each episode?
Well, for me, I mean, I actually think the biggest challenges were not mine. I had fun. Like, to me, this was, I was in a candy store. Like, I was like, I'm going to imagine a story in this place. Like, what if we went into a mine in Uruguay or whatever? I just would imagine things. The biggest challenge, I think, was the, like, all the producers and the logistical schedulers who are, like, trying to do this 6-dimensional schedule with all these production teams and camera equipment and, if we did a red eye and then another red eye right after that, like, would this work? I think, in a way, that was a serious feat. And for me, like, I'm so used to, just as a radio reporter, like, you just put a mic in a bag and you just go. And TV is not like that.
Yeah, the first episode is about surveillance, and your mind is blown on a very regular basis by something that you learn. What was the most mind-blowing thing you learned in the surveillance episode?
Oh, in the surveillance episode, I think the most mind-blowing thing I learned was when I talked to this woman in Paris named Judith, who's a reporter, but also she was an active Tinder user, and she managed to get from Tinder basically the raw data that they had about her. And I was sitting with her at a cafe table, and she just plunked it on the table.
Oh my God.
Wait, that's not it.
Oh my God, there's more.
Yeah, can you believe it?
This is just about you.
Just about me and my crappy
Your
dating life.
Your love life.
Yeah.
And for me, the kind of feeling of that, like, because what was in that stack of data that they had about her was not just her Tinder swipes and the messages she was sending to, you know, potential partners, like, which is creepy enough in a way. It was also all these other things. It was things she had done on other apps. So, like, that, just that feeling that it's like, and this is what blew my mind, all the apps on your phone, they're talking to each other about you behind your back. And that, to me, that I was like, huh, I did not realize that.
Now, having seen this, what was or what is the cost to you?
It's like my most intimate secrets. Yeah, I mean, for me, it has a huge value. Yeah.
It just made me sort of, right after that interview, I remember like looking down at my phone and looking at all the tiles of the apps and being like, who is saying what about me to whom here?
Very Orwellian. Jeez, it was, yeah. Really kind of creepy, yeah. And frightening, yeah. You're a producer and director of research for Radiolab. You've done stories on snowflake photography and medieval robots, among other things. Was it a difficult adjustment to shift your storytelling from audio to video?
Yes and no. I mean, no in the sense that, like, I have a kind of obsessive personality. I get excited about a lot of things, and then I get excited hard. And that basically is my only professional superpower, I think. Enthusiasm, you know? That said, there are so many things I never even considered. Like, if you watch TV and you're seeing an episode of a hosted show and the host is just sort of walking alone through the desert, like, I don't know, in my head, I just thought they were alone. They are not alone. there's an entire camera crew behind them, all the support staff, so many people, so many logistical schedulers, so many, you know, location releases, so many this, that, the other thing. There's so much more to it, to making TV, actually. And in a way, obviously, there are pluses to that, too. Like, the graphics folks that I worked with, they're these sort of Terry Gilliam-esque, just wild minds. I would give them crazier and crazier assignments or ideas, and they would come back with these, like, beautiful, bespoke, bizarro creations. So that was a thing where I was like, oh, this is just a whole new level of fun. Like, I can't believe that I could take my storytelling and pop it out an extra dimension.
Yeah, yeah. How are you handling being the face of something instead of just the disembodied voice?
I think it's been weird for some regular Radiolab listeners to see my body, my persona. But I think, I mean, there were so many moments early on in the early shoots where I would later watch the footage and, like, I'd be like, why are you nodding so much? Why is your hand, like, all over up in your face? Like, what are you doing? The other thing is, and I mean, you know this because literally we're doing it right now. We're recording ourselves on separate tracks. So if you reacted to something I said, like, you could cut it out later. I happen to be a very vocal interviewer, so I'll be like, wow, oh man, oh amazing. Like, and I just do that naturally, and then I, like, cut it all out because I'm, like, embarrassed of my zealousness. But you can't do that in TV because you're right in the same place with the person, you know, talking to them in real time.
Yeah.
So yeah, there were just all these things that I had to learn the hard way. What it meant to actually have a body in a real space and on a screen.
Yeah, but you shouldn't be embarrassed by your zealousness, because I thought the nodding worked really well. And as you mentioned, your superpower is your enthusiasm, although I think you have more superpowers than that. So, but I mean, that's what, yeah. So, a couple of years ago, you wrote a guide to finding stories called The World's Biggest Scavenger Hunt. Can you share a couple of your favorite tips with us? Not that we need your help or anything. I mean, we are talking to you, aren't we? So we are obviously doing something right, but.
Well, I think to me, that's pretty much my job, right? It's my job is to find stories, and it's the part of my job I love the most. And so often, that's when I tell a story, that's the first question everyone has. And so that's why I wrote that sort of manifesto. And the manifesto is kind of, I think there are a lot of, like, little handy tips and tricks in there. But the big point of it, I think, that I really wanted to get across was there's this feeling that people have where it's like, oh my God, how do I find stories? I'm so stuck. I don't even know how to do that. And to me, it requires a reframe. So, like, you're like, okay, just imagine there are however many, 7 billion people on planet Earth. If you imagine that even a fraction of them, 10%, even 1% of them have interesting stories worth telling, you're into a number here that is still, it's, you know, that all the news outlets in all the world could not possibly cover. And that those are just alive people. You also have dead people, and you also have animals and plants and microbes and stars and companies and planets. There are just a million things. And to me, it's like this feeling that there is around us, there is an infinity of stories. And so the fun for my job, it's a scavenger hunt. It's like, I went raspberry picking the other day, and it's like, you're looking for just the right raspberry, you know? And it's to me, that's, there's just such a thrill in that. And I love the hunt. And I think if you think about it that way, as opposed to, oh God, I'm on deadline, I need a thing by tomorrow, and I'm like, that makes it sort of stressful and homeworky. But the idea of, like, I'm going raspberry picking, like, this is going to be fun. Yeah. To me, if you flip it like that, all of a sudden stories just sort of bubble up around you.
Yeah, yeah. You recently released a limited investigative podcast called The Other Latif. Who is The Other Latif, and how did you discover him?
Yeah, this was one of the eeriest moments of my life. I was on Twitter, I was procrastinating, and then I saw someone tweeting about me to the president of the United States. And I was like, what does this even mean? And it turned out they weren't tweeting about me. They were tweeting about this other guy who had my same name, who was a detainee at Guantanamo Bay, detainee 244. And so I just started trying to find as much as I could about this guy. What I found was that the government basically alleged that he was a top aide to Osama bin Laden. He was Al-Qaeda's top explosives expert. Just they painted a picture of this guy as very, very, very scary. And then I talked to his lawyer, who basically said, no, he was never in Al-Qaeda, didn't have a relationship with Osama bin Laden. This guy was just wrong place, wrong time, and he's been in Guantanamo for almost 20 years without charges even. And to boot, in 2016, the Obama administration and a number of like career civil servants in the Obama administration unanimously decided to let this guy go home to Morocco. But for mysterious reasons that I tried to uncover in the podcast, he's still there. He's still in Guantanamo, you know, 4 years later. So to me, I found all this out. My head was totally spinning. It felt very eerie that this could be happening to a guy with my name. And so I basically spent 3 years investigating who this guy is, whether he did what he said, what the U.S. government said he did, what the evidence for that was, what kind of I thought actually should happen to this guy. It's kind of like this guy never got a trial, and then the only trial he ever got was like in a podcast.
Mm-hmm. You met his family, right?
I did.
How were you received by them?
Oh man, it was overwhelming. I walked into his home in Casablanca. This was the home that this man, the guy in Guantanamo, who I'm not allowed to meet or talk to, he was born and raised in this home. And I walk in, he has a bunch of brothers and sisters. His parents are dead. His dad died while he was in Guantanamo. His sister, when she saw me, she just looked at me and she just gasped. And then she kind of ran up to me and she said, basically through an interpreter, like, look, I knew you were coming. I knew you had his name, but what I didn't realize is you had his height, you had his build, you look like him, and you're the age that he was when I last saw him. And I just froze. Like, there have been so few moments like this in my career as a journalist where, like, I just froze. I did not know what to do. And then she just grabbed my arm.
You are like my brother. You are my brother. My brother who was still to come. She said that you are like her brother who are waiting for to come. I see the innocence that's in his face, in his features that are similar to their brother. You are a new member of the family.
You are a brother of them. You have to know everything about him.
They asked to see photos of my son back home.
Is this a good one?
Yeah.
Okay, here. My son.
Halili.
How beautiful.
Just then.
Hi. He's this guy's age.
One of the really little kids came into the room and hugged my leg. That story was like unlike any other story, and that moment was unlike any other moment in my career.
Yeah, wow, that's an amazing story. Well, one of our favorite episodes of Radiolab is one that you did. It focuses on the NHL All-Star Game and a player named John Scott. What's the story there?
Oh, this is just, I love this story so much. It's the story of a practical joke, a kind of a mean practical joke. Basically, what happened is that the NHL in 2016 opened up who should go to the All-Star game to fan voting. And fans, basically, there was this sort of mischievous band of podcasters who came up with this idea that what if we voted the worst guy in the league to the All-Star game? And basically, that joke took off. Went viral. Like, this guy got more votes than, you know, the next few people combined. He soared to the top of the voting so much so that they like took the numbers off the website because it sort of made them look bad.
Wow.
And so this guy, he's a big, burly kind of a guy. He's what's called an enforcer. He's like I don't need to tell anybody from Wisconsin about hockey, I guess. But he's not an all-star, and he was the first one to admit it. But basically what ended up happening was this guy goes, Cinderella-like, goes to the all-star game and ends up playing the best game of his life.
John's just like a few feet from goal, and the goalie's actually out of position.
I had a wide open net, and I shot it, and I missed the net.
Like a wide open net.
But the goalie was luckily sliding back into position.
And so the puck hit the goalie, bounced off the goalie, and Scott! Into the back of the net.
Scores! Johnny Scott! There you go.
It was cool. Everybody went nuts. That was the neat thing. The crowd, I didn't know how they were going to react. Usually they boo me because everybody booed me, and they were all for it.
And John Scott will get a standing ovation.
Up until that point in his career, he had scored, if I'm remembering right, I think it was 5 goals in his whole career. And then he scored 2 goals in this one game, one MVP of the NHL All-Star Game, which is like, you know, the best hockey players in the world among them. And he just excelled. And it was this story of, well, I think we called it a goof on a goon. Yeah, that then sort of flipped back around to have a totally Disney ending.
Yeah. Wow, yeah, that's amazing. And then when John went back to the like regular games, was he able to maintain the magic that he displayed in the All-Star game?
Oh, he pretty much retired right after that. He's like,
okay,
I'm leaving on a high note.
Okay, exactly.
I'm leaving on a high note. Yeah. I can't top that.
Yeah. Well, so what is next for the increasingly influential Latif Nasser brand? Endorsement deals, political office, maybe your own line of stylish dog shirts?
Yes, I'm, you know, signing all kinds of shoe endorsements and sadly the world of public radio and documentary film is not as lucrative and shiny as that. But I don't know. I feel like I'm in a groove, and I feel like this weird superpower that I seem to have, which is that I just get obsessed about things. I get enthusiastic about things. Like I'm just going to keep doing that because I think that there's so much that's scary and wrong and horrible and sad that's going on all around us. But there's also so much beautiful and poetic and worth, you know, shouting from the rooftops. And like, that's my job. And I'm okay with that being my job. And I think that hopefully it'll make a difference, and it'll make some meaning out of this crazy world that we live in. And that's what I want to keep doing.
Yeah. Latif Nasser, thank you very much.
I'm so flattered. Thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure.
Latif Nasser is the host of the Netflix docuseries Connected, The Hidden Science of Everything. You can find out more about Latif and Connected at wpr.org/beta.
If you've got like the relative or the friends who have the political view that makes you crazy, there's a way to navigate that such that we're not enemies.
Wisconsinite Melissa Falavino talks about her critically acclaimed essay collection, Tomboyland. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
In the Midwest, softball is something of a hallowed thing for girls. Here in America's heartland, where so many girls are born and raised by generations of farm families, their bodies built for baling hay, their shoulders broad, their backs and hands strong, their muscles long and lean, like they were born to play ball, like they came out of the womb with gloves on their hands, cleats already digging into the dirt. Growing up in a small town where boys were boys and girls were girls, playing softball also meant being called a lesbian. This was the worst possible insult, one we worked hard to combat. It meant applying too much makeup, even and perhaps especially before games, making sure our hair was just right, straightened and sprayed at lockers between class, wearing short skirts and high heels and low-cut shirts on game days. All this to assure the boys and the men that even though we played softball, we were still girls, that we were sexy, available, and straight, that our bodies were objects for them to desire.
That's writer Melissa Falavino reading an excerpt from her essay, Switch Hitter. It's part of her debut collection titled Tomboyland. Melissa was born and raised in working-class Wisconsin. She's a first-generation college graduate and a former high school softball star. Her collection grapples with her Dairyland upbringing and its impact on identity, gender, and class. Wisconsin Life host and producer Maureen McCollum caught up with Melissa to talk about Tomboyland. And she found the perfect spot to meet Melissa.
Oh my God, we are in my absolute favorite place on the planet, which is center field at Olbrich Park. I think it's field number 3?
Yes.
Sitting in center field in Packer chairs that Maureen brought. It is actually a perfect day. You can probably hear the crickets everywhere. And this is where I played softball for actually like many, many years. I played softball here when I was a kid, but then I played here again later as an adult. I played on a women's fast pitch league, and center field was my position, so I feel like I am
like you're at home. One of the things that I really love about Switch Hitter, you take this one facet of your life and you do this deep identity dive while looking through the lens of sports and softball. And like who you were and who you've become when you look at sports. Can you explain why you decided to write that section?
Yeah, I mean, I started writing about softball and I wasn't really sure what I was writing about, you know? And this is how I enter all essays. I like have a thing that I'm thinking about or that's obsessing me or a question that I have in my mind and I start writing into it. I don't know where I'm going. And then suddenly, as if by magic, I figure out what it is I'm trying to do or what question I'm trying to ask. And I knew that I wanted to write about softball because it was such an important part of my life and I knew it was complex.
You were a big deal in the Mount Hora world of softball.
In the world of small town sports, I guess I was something of a big deal. You know, it was my life and it was my plan and I was going to go play D1 softball at UW and I got close and then totally failed and had this like this experience where I worked so hard and was a total perfectionist toward this one goal, and I was not used to not meeting my goals as a perfectionist, both academically and as an athlete when I was a kid. And, you know, I went to these tryouts at the UW-Madison, and I choked. And the whole trajectory of my life changed. You know, everything that I sort of expected I was going to do and be didn't happen. And I took this totally different route and became a writer. And that there's still some grief though, you know, like, and I grieve that life that playing the sport competitively like that, what that did for me as a kid. And so I knew that I wanted to write about that, but then I was like, oh, there's so much more here. So I get into the ways that we as girls, when we're young, we learn to perform under the male gaze. And even if it's not told to us explicitly, we learn it implicitly. And like everything that we do, maybe especially in a small town, about being desired and being attractive and being popular and being objects for boys and, you know, sometimes even adult men to want. And so, yeah, it got real dark for a while. Sure. And I was like, okay, we're just going to plumb those depths.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty vulnerable piece. And there's a lot of things that I still am like freaked out to have in the world. And there are days when I'm like, why would I do that? Why would I write that? But but the cool thing has been having mostly, you know, predominantly women, a lot of queer women, you know, writing me and saying like, oh man, I identified so hard with this. And like, I feel like you were writing my story. And this, it's such a ubiquitous thing, girls playing sports, you know, but there's so much complexity there. Especially within the realm of identity and the body and desire. So,
one thing that really stuck with me is how you talked about how you were building your body to be a machine. And there was specifically when it came up in the high school weight room.
Yeah.
So you were building your body to be this strong muscle.
Yes.
And then at other times you were building your body to be like a machine for sex and like finding your own power in whatever ways.
Yeah, you know, and that was a big part of it. Like the way that we sculpt our bodies to fit into the shape that we understand they need to be in order to be what we think is powerful. And it wasn't until much later in life when I started to inhabit my body in the way that I inhabit it now, which is like much less feminine, much more androgynously, and understanding that that was actually where I felt most powerful and where I felt most at home in my body. And so much of that was derby, was roller derby, and returning to softball and being like at home on the field again and feeling like, okay, I'm back in my domain. I'm standing in center field again. You know, it's just this like pure joy again, you know, like it was when I was a kid. So
let's talk about moths.
All right. Yeah, cool.
What I really like about this book is how you take some of these details about your life and things that maybe I would consider mundane in my own life, like an infestation of pantry moths. But I just love how you write about them in this like beautiful and eventually like very empathetic way. You know, most of us have had pantry moths, like they're gross.
Yeah.
You want to do what you can to get rid of them, but like you develop this relationship with them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I love my moths. I mean, I don't have them anymore. This was an old apartment, but
it's kind of good.
Yeah. I'm okay without them. But you know, that piece I wrote after moving to New York, you know, that was the earliest one I wrote from the collection in the book. And I was really isolated and really alone and lonely, I guess, but not like, I kind of liked the loneliness, you know? These moths showed up. And my roommates and I did the thing that you do when you get an infestation, which is you try to eradicate them. I just had this experience one night where I was like in like a blind killing rampage. And I just sort of like had this moment of empathy for these like struggling little creatures. And I was like, that's interesting. And so I think I just started writing from that place. And they just sort of like accompanied me through the whole process of writing this piece. I was writing about them and they were like buzzing around my lamps in my bedroom as I wrote. And, you know, then one died in a candle and I just felt like this deep swell of grief and was like, wow, that was interesting.
Another thing that really sticks out to me in these essays is like you lay it all out there.
For better or worse.
It's all out there. And you and I recognize that most people in the world are extremely complex people. And sometimes we fall short in recognizing the complexities in one another. It's something I have to check myself when I'm, you know, interacting with a friend or family member or a complete stranger, like, okay, so what else is going on here? So like, do you think it's important that more of us just understand the complexities in one another?
Yeah, 100%. You know, I think that we are so, as like a country, you know, and as a world, we are so divided. And, you know, so in some respects, I feel like some of that division will never change. You know, there's just not going to be unity on some things, some issues and some belief systems, you know, there just won't be. And part of that is what makes the world an interesting place. But I think that having empathy for people who don't believe the same things as you do, even if they make you like crazy, to, you know, if you've got like the relative or the friends who like have the political view that makes you crazy, there's a way to navigate that such that we're not enemies. Even in circumstances where like people don't believe that, for instance, gay people should get rights like straight people do, or like that trans people are real, I at once want to throttle them, you know, and never talk to them again. But there's part of me that is driven by this like need to sort of try to have a conversation and get them to understand what I understand in the hope that maybe they will change their mind about certain things. Or if not change their mind, then just have a better understanding of the complexities of people, and that beyond that, none of us is one thing nor the other, that we are all this multitude of things and we're all just trying to survive and live on this planet and not die, you know? And like, that's what we're trying to do here, you know? And like,
keep on trucking.
Yeah. And if we take some time to talk to people or read stories or listen to people tell their stories, we might learn something. And that doesn't mean that we're always going to reconcile, you know? Like, there are still people in this world who I'm not going to ever be friends with, you know? But maybe someone out there will read my book and understand something that they didn't before about the complexities of life and like one human body.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for doing this. This has been amazing.
Thank you for having me. This has literally been my favorite interview ever and pretty much the best day of my life. I mean, this is all I ever want to do.
Marissa Falavino is the author of the essay collection Tomboyland. She spoke with Wisconsin Life host Maureen McCollum. Find out more about Melissa at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Cristela Alonso, Latif Nasser, and Melissa Falavino. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to guest interviewer Maureen McCollum.
Yeah, we called her our maestro of motivation.
Also, a special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
Act civilized! We got company!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
He's got every high-tech thing you'll ever need.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Whoa! Almost makes me feel sorry for the guy. Not really!
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. Take care and stay safe. I'm Doug Gordon.
You could talk a snowmobile into an air conditioner.